So I want to make sure that, because it can't be that every time a member speaks, you have to make a comment about how this member is asking a question. It's just unheard of. You've been continuously doing this up to so
no,
far.
No, Chair. Please don't create a
dialogue. Do not create a dialogue, Advocate Mpofu.
Yeah, but don't misrepresent the
on
facts.
On the platform.
Don't misrepresent the facts. Every time a member speaks, I speak. When did that happen?
I'm not misrepresenting the facts.
You just said every time. That's not true.
Order, Jefferson.
I'm on the platform. Stop speaking, Advocate Mpofu.
Order, Jefferson.
So I want to complete this. I note your order, Honorable Nodat. I will give you an opportunity, because I don't think we can continue in this way. Constant kind of disrupting and trying to determine in what way members should be asking their questions. So okay. And I want to proceed to the next members.
Honorable Chair,
your order, please. Honorable Nodat.
Honorable Chair, can I please speak before that?
Chair, please note
Chair President, there's an order, Chair.
Yes, yes. Honorable Nodat, I recognize you.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. Chairperson, we've got rules here. We've got directives here. When a member is speaking on the floor, they're not supposed to be interrupted. If you're making a ruling as a chairperson, you must conclude that ruling. You must hear what that ruling is, and then you must take it from there. But these interjections are really disrupting the whole meeting. It's making it degenerate. And on top of that, the point that has been raised is completely out of order, Chairperson, because we are here to get the information that we need to get. We are legislators. We're not lawyers. But we're here in this committee to get the information that we require to do the work of legislators. So please, Chairperson, can you make sure that the meeting is in order and we're not disrupted when we're doing our work, because we don't disrupt people when they're doing their own work as well. Thank you so much, Chair.
Really? Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Nodat. Stop responding and unmuting yourself and speak without being recognized, Advocate Mpofu.
Okay, Chair.
I'm going to give you for the last time and I'll make the ruling.
All right. No, Chair. So, thank you, Chair. I'm sorry about that. Firstly, the member who just spoke is just, I don't know if he has been in this committee and how many times I've been interrupted unnecessarily and complained about it. I've never heard him protecting me. I'm saying, Chair, I have a right to object if there's an irrelevant point being raised. That's why I said to you patiently, I didn't want to interrupt the member. It happened about 4 or 5 members ago. And when Honorable Heron was speaking, I said I would have spoken just before that, but you didn't see my hand. It was out of respect because I didn't want to interrupt people while they're speaking. But it is my duty to raise objections of relevance. That's all I'm doing. I will never stop doing that while I'm still here. I have to do it, because if I don't do it, then it is going to remain on the record. You can rule against me, that's fine, that's your prerogative. But the rules say that you, Chair, and that's why I'm addressing you, you are the person who determines when there's an objection about relevance. And you can determine it in my favor or against me, that's fine, I'll accept that. But I cannot be stopped from raising an objection. That's just not how it works. And I'm not interfering with your things about predetermined outcomes and so on. I'm simply raising an objection.
That's fine.
And it might be right or it might be wrong. That's it.
That's fair. Thank you, Advocate Mpofu. The point you've raised is not sustained, and therefore I proceed. I now recognize Honorable Mautwe.
I've raised the point of order as well, Chair.
Before you come, Honorable Mautwe, Honorable Zungula, your point of order?
Chairperson, in light what Honorable Nodat I said, I want to join in his views on the meeting must not degenerate. Firstly, Advocate Mpofu is well within his rights and responsibilities to raise a point of order, especially when it concerns to issues of relevance. Secondly, Honorable Nodata is very correct when he is addressing the issue of, when one person is on the floor, another one speaks. I've picked up that when Advocate Mbofu is addressing, you do interject, and that creates the dialogue that you are saying you don't want. And lastly, Chairperson, Advocate Mbofu must correct you when you are saying something that he did not say or something that is wrong. Just now, you stated that every time that members are asking or engaging the witness, Advocate Mbofu interjects or asks questions. And that is not true. We've been listening all this time. He's not addressing or wanting to comment every time a member of parliament is actually engaging the witness. So it can't be correct that when he's addressing that is not correct. You want to stop him and you don't want him to correct you when you are wrong in your assertion. So I wanted Chair to raise those issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Zungula. Your point of order is not sustained. Chair, proceed.
Chair, sorry, I'm on another point completely. Sorry, Chair.
Chair, my hand is raised.
Yes, Honorable Lotrit.
Thank you, Chairperson. Not to belabor the points, but I do think it is important that you do rule on Advocate Mpofu's assertion now that this committee has a predetermined outcome. No. I think it is casting aspersions on this committee. We are here to listen with open minds, and I would honestly want you to rule in this regard. It puts us in an absolutely uncomfortable position if that is said of the members of the committee.
No, thank you, Honorable Lothrit. I would have missed that point. Otherwise, we have consistently made our clear about that. I missed it, getting that. Advocate Mbofu, did you say that?
No, Chair, I didn't say anything of the sort. You, Chair, said that when you were responding to me, that you don't have a predetermined outcome and so on. So I said, no, I'm not on the point. I'm not on that point at all. So it's you, not me, Chair. But I mean, this is the kind of thing, but that's fine. Okay. Then we're not supposed to make corrections. Yeah. Chair, I wanted to make another point. Sorry, completely different. We've observed that this witness is in the company of someone who keeps on whispering to him. Can you find out who that person is?
Thank you, Advocate Mbofu. I have not picked that up. I have not seen or heard it, but I will confirm with him as I go to Honorable Maotwe. Mr. Pillay, do you have a challenge where you are? Are you having people whispering around you?
You're muted.
Sorry. Please mute yourself too, Advocate Mbofu.
Okay, you've
done speaking.
I'm done.
I have my family around, Mr. Chair.
You are in the house?
Yes, in the house. So I apologize.
Okay. Thank you.
Chairperson, no. I'm sorry, Chair. No. I don't know what you're doing now, Chairperson. I'm not talking about the house. I'm saying he has people whispering information to him, and you are leading him to say it's people in the house. Why do I care about people in the house? The people who are whispering to him, you must ask him about that, because that's wrong. It's illegal.
Yeah. Honorable Heron.
Yeah, Chair, I think to be fair and honest, we have to acknowledge that when I was asking questions, someone was whispering to Mr. Pillay about Sunday Times.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Heron. You are the new chairperson.
Mr. Pillay?
Yes, my spouse is here, and she, you know, she whispers to me sometimes, and she's working also in the house. But I apologize.
Okay. Apology accepted. Thank you. Let's proceed, Honorable Mauta.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good evening to you, Mr. Pile. We previously had Mr. Johan van Loggenberg here as a witness, and he was at pains to explain that he does not like people using the word rogue unit. Do you also feel strongly against the use of the description of SARS intelligence unit, the rogue unit?
I feel strongly about it, and I think it says a lot about a person whether you take objection to it or whether you want to use it.
Okay, and Mr. Pile, it is clear that when you started working at SARS, your highest qualification was matric. So just for the record, you know, affidavit paragraph number one, wherein you stated that you were formerly employed by SARS in various positions, including as a deputy commissioner of SARS, and you're employed in all these positions, only with standard 10. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And, okay, let's move from that one. Would you say that had the state security agency finalized the MOU with SARS at the time when there were discussions, including seeking of funding approval from the National Treasury to bring to the table its constitutional mandate to be the only entity together with SAPS and Defence to conduct intelligence surveillance, we wouldn't have had the whole rogue unit saga.
If I've understood the question properly, Honourable Member, the judgment on the unit has found that the establishment of such a type of unit is lawful. The establishment itself is not unlawful. There have also been other opinions. So the view that the unit in practice, its very foundation breached the law, was rejected by the judgment in the matter. But also SARS, after 2014, received such an opinion from Advocate Trengrove, where he also said the founding of a unit in practice like the one that there was is not in itself in breach of the Constitution or of the law. Thank you. Check.
Okay. For the sake of progress, I'll move. Now, earlier on during the cross-examination by Advocate Dalimpo of Wusina Council, he asked that all investigation that found the so-called Zobini to be illegal relied on the fact that SARS does not have mandate to conduct intelligence surveillance. Did you agree to this? I missed your response on this. You were not very clear. Can you please respond?
Okay, so the opinion given to SARS, even after I left SARS, by Advocate Trengrove gives a very, very helpful interpretation of what the law allows and does not allow. So, for example, it can be okay to have surveillance in a state property. And in fact, there is an example that members of SARS enforcement, when they were expecting attempts to raid a SARS warehouse, customs warehouse, they were put to do early surveillance, and that was a state property. Another example is where there was a surveillance of a cigarette manufacturer, and the surveillance was not done directly by us, but there happened to be a Metro Police camera which was focused nearby. our people were able to liaise with the Metro Police and use the footage to identify the movements. So, for example, counting the number of trucks that move in and out, and to be able to make an estimation of the quantity of tobacco that's moving in and the quantity of cigarettes that's finally, and comparing it with the quantity of cigarettes that's finally manufactured. So there is no blanket, my understanding, according to the judgments and according to the opinion of Advocate Trengrove, there's no blanket view that this is unlawful. It's about how it is set up and what its activities are.
So you are saying it was okay to establish the rogue unit at SARS in a nutshell? Is that what you are saying?
No, I'm saying it was okay to establish the type of unit that we established in SARS, bearing in mind that the type of unit that we finally established was different from the original conception. The original conception was actually to create something jointly with NIA and housed in NIA that would then use NIA's full powers. We did not succeed in that because at some point NIA grew cold on that type of solution. We then had to work out something for our own, and we tried as best as we could to stick to within the law. This unit, as Mr. Van Lochrenberg said, has carried out 81 projects over a period, and for most of its time, it only comprised of 7 people, and it did some real good work.
Okay, in the interest of time, we'll move. Let's talk about your retirement saga now. Do you think it is fair that you benefited from package where SARS paid over 1 million of taxpayers' money in penalties? I mean, you now live in Holland, while majority of our people here in South Africa live in squalor. It's even a joke to you. You are smiling now when you've got your family around you, when our people are living in squatter camps.
So, by the way, I don't live in the Netherlands. I'm here because to visit the extended family, and I'm here because of the bereavement in the family. So I have not emigrated. I live in South Africa. I live in Pretoria. That's one. The second thing is that the package in which the penalty was paid for me was lawful. And secondly, the then commissioner pointed out, and I pointed out in my affidavit, that over a period of time, in fact, SARS saves, because SARS wouldn't be paying towards my pension and any other such extras. Thank you.
Okay. So, Mr. Pile, are you saying if it had been anyone in your position, would you not have more than a decade-long relationship with Mr. Godan? Would have been given their pension, SARS would have paid the money owed to GEPF, and any other person would have been rehired for a position that does not even have a job description?
So, honourable member, that is a decision that the commissioner, then commissioner of SARS, and the minister should make. Is it of value to them to have me? That is their decision. It's not a decision I make. And the commissioner explains it in his affidavit. His view was that they should have me. They should have me there. They could have said no. Then my alternative would be to actually retire and take all my pension fund and move on. The decision was in their hands. It is not my decision. Thank you.
So do you know anyone, Mr. Pile, in the whole of South Africa who ever retired, accessed his pension, and was rehired the same way that you were rehired as SARS, at the same salary with less responsibilities? Is there anyone that has ever gone through what you went through?
I believe statistically there would be. I showed you, or rather the legal representative of the public protector showed you four examples in SARS. I do agree, I actually don't know, but I think it would be that they did not have the early retirement benefit. Because remember, the early retirement benefit means that the calculation is pegged off at a particular a year. The two gentlemen that are named by Advocate Dali Mpofu were hired the next day after they retired, but they didn't ask for, and they didn't need to ask for early retirement. They reached retirement age. Thank you.
How did the members of the ROC unit got to be known to have the spying unit such that the private company contracted them to assist them in installing the spying unit at the MPA? And do you think there was a coincidence that it was your members of the ROC unit that they were awarded?
Okay, so firstly, I must say that the ROC unit that I know is a ROC unit in the SSA. This unit matters as before the court, and the judgment has said this unit has been lawfully formed. And thus far, nobody has found its activities to be unlawful. So it is explained, as far as I understand, in that some of these people who worked at the DSO and some of these people that worked at SARS knew each other. They had reputations, and they were known to be people who had technical experience. So they phoned up somebody they knew. They didn't come to me. They didn't come to SARS as SARS. They spoke to individuals that they knew, and they made an arrangement with them.
And to your knowledge, was it the first time that such spying unit was being installed at the NPA?
I don't know, and as I say, I don't know that this is spying unit. This is for the DSO's purposes. I'm not aware. I'm not privy to what is happening within the DSO.
DSO. Okay, let's move on that one, Mr. Pile. So based on
your last points.
Okay, how did you determine that? But anyway, I'll club my points together.
I determine in the way I do it. Thank you, Honorable Maud.
You don't have to respond to everything, Chair. Based on errors, Mr. Pile, made by the courts in paragraph 113, 115, and 116, would you say the PP was well within her right to apply for appeal? And should this committee rely on those judgments, irrespective? And lastly, Mr. Pile, just as a comment, I'm not sure when are you coming back to South Africa, because as soon as you come, you must pay back the money that was paid to you, illegally to you, and unlawfully. Thank you, Chair.
Your response, Mr. Pile?
Can she just repeat that question?
Not the comment, the question.
Yeah,
the point is that you must come back home and give back our money, taxpayers' money. But my question was based on errors made by the courts in paragraph 113, 115, and 116. Would you say the PP was well within her right to apply for appeal? And equally, should this committee rely on those judgments irrespective?
Well, I can only talk about three matters, and I've put the three matters before you. In the one matter, it's appealed right up to the Constitutional Court and the judgments have been confirmed. On the second matter, we have heard today, and I think we've heard previously, that there's one matter that I am aware of, that I, or rather I can remember, that the Public Protector's Office takes issue with. I don't know how that will come out in an appeal. And I don't know whether that one matter will change the whole judgment. And I'm not a lawyer. I think in the end, it won't change the overall thrust of the judgment.
Thank you.
And then I haven't integrated. I'm coming back to South Africa. Yeah.
Okay.
Honorable Zungu. Sorry, Chair. I missed his last sentence about South Africa. Sorry, Chair.
He said he's coming back to South Africa.
Oh, to give us our money back. Okay, thank you.
Honorable Zungula.
Thank you. Mr. Pillay, can we agree when I am covered with your answer, I can stop you so that you don't have to go on and on?
Yes. To you, Chair, yes.
Okay. So would you agree that the position of being commissioner or acting commissioner is equivalent of being a DG of a government department?
Yes.
Now, do you agree that DGs of departments have, for the longest time, needed to have a post-matric qualification of 3 years or equivalent?
I agree.
Okay. So why do you think it was proper for you to hold such a position that you agree that it is equivalent of being a DG without even having a matric certificate?
Well, the one thing I can say to you is that an assessment was done of all the members of the executive at that time. It was, we went through a battery of tests over 4.5 days. I think there was, I don't know, 7, 8 of us who underwent that test. And we called it the goodness of fit. I performed the best out of everybody in that test. I would say that assessment might have influenced the way Commissioner Obam Magashula saw things and the way Minister Godan saw things.
So this assessment, it was not independently done. It was done by your boss, basically.
No, it was done by Hay consultants from the United States, who spent I'm not sure, something like 2 months here in SARS, and they put most of the middle and senior managers through assessments.
Is it SACA accredited?
I don't know, but you know, at that stage when the tests were done, Commissioner Opa Magashula was our head of HR, and he's regarded as really a fundi in HR matters. I would say it would have been an assessment of quite a high caliber.
So basically, your experience has never been quantified independently by SACA?
No. The way I understand it is usually if you want to go and Yeah, you want to, usually when you want to go and do further studies, then you go for such an assessment, yes. I haven't gone to for such a formal process.
Okay, all right. No, as long as you agree that your position was equivalent to a DG, and the DGs have for the longest time required a post-matric qualification, which you did not have, and your experience was not quantified by SACA, so there is no independent authority which should be doing that work of quantifying your experience. So we agree on those points. But the next point would be, did you get your due lump sum on your retirement?
Yes, I got a one-third lump sum on my retirement.
Okay. Did you not perhaps think there's something wrong if you got your lump sum hardly because you had retired hardly days, then you are appointed for somewhat the same position?
So, Honorable Member, the way I understand it is that retirement, which is retirement essentially from the pension fund and the rehiring, there are a few people where it has taken place in SARS, as was shown on the screen, but there are also thousands of people in the public service who were retired in that way and hired on contracts for a relatively short period and for sometimes specific projects. So it was really not that aspect of retirement from the fund and rehiring on contract is not a strange thing.
Okay. So what would happen if to the fiscus, if all civil servants do that in our country? You know, all civil servants like you, they retire, get their lump sum, a day later they get to be appointed. What would happen to the fiscus? What impact that would have on the fiscus?
Everybody above 55 can take early retirement, is my understanding. I didn't take retirement at 40 or something like that. I took a retirement there. I took retirement, 3 years shy of 60. It's an early retirement. And obviously the government and the fund manages things in such a way that these things are controlled.
Okay, so where the other people rehired to the same position, and did SARS pay the penalty and were they under 60? Because what I'm trying to ascertain here is that, is it a normality what the manner in which you retired, got the lump sum and were rehired? Was it something that happens only to you, or it was something that is a norm in our country when it comes to civil servants?
All right. So this one straight answer is that I don't know. What I know is that I wanted to access my money in the pension fund. So I wanted to retire from the fund. And I asked for to be rehired. And it's there, apparently, and that's the key decision. If the early retirement is agreed to, that what kicks in is that the penalty is then paid by the employer.
Did I hear you correctly? You said you wanted to retire because you wanted access to your funds.
Yeah.
And you wanted to be rehired.
Yes.
So it was something that you were in discussion with your the then bosses, that the purpose of you retiring, it is basically to get the lump sum. However, you want to be rehired. So it was something that is well planned. So as they're accepting you retiring, they knew that there was a plan to rehire you.
Well, I don't know about a plan to rehire me. It's a request I made. And SARS could have said, no, you retire and you go. It's a decision that SARS had to make.
Okay, now let's move. So in this retirement, did the court sanction you and Mr. Godan with punitive costs for accusing the PP without evidence of working with state capture operators?
Yes, there are certain paragraphs that were struck out, and there are certain costs that we were landed with.
Okay. All right. No, I think I'm done, because I think for me what was important was the admission that you retired for the purposes of accessing your lump sum, and then you wanted to be rehired. So that is the most important, admission that you made. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Zungula. And I recognize Honorable Suela.
Thank you, Chairperson. I can't open my video because of load shedding. Greetings to you, Chair. Greetings to Advocate Mpofu and his team, and Advocate Bao, together with my colleagues. I think I have got two questions which I want to pose to Mr. Evan Pillar. The first one is in relation with your investigation by the PP. Would you attribute the manner in which the PP handled your investigation and how she treated you, as well as the findings made by the courts, as the PP lacking the knowledge or skills to effectively perform her duties as a protector of the public? That's the first question. Thank you.
Through you, Chair. Thank you for the question. As I've said to, I think previously, the judgments are replete with comments about the efficiency and effectiveness of the public protector. And there are many times when it talks about irrational conclusions. There are many times when it says there's no evidence. There are many times when it says the evidence that we put forward was not taken into account. In both the judgments, more in the second judgment than the first judgment, there are very, very clear indications of the efficiency and effectiveness of the public protector. I think it's up to members then to say whether this is relevant for the work that they have to do in the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. The next question still is in relation with the investigation. Do you think the manner in which the PP handled your investigations, she deliberately disregarded the law and facts to come to a predetermined outcome, What do you think led her to behave the way she did? Does this in any way indicate that she is pursuing a political agenda?
Thank you, Honourable Member. I've said earlier, I think there's a pattern in the way things are done. And I don't think the pattern only applies to my cases. I think there are a number of instances now where questions have been raised about whether the investigations are approached with an open mind. And whether evidence is assessed in the right way, competing evidence. And I think the judgments are very, very clear in many instances, but I wouldn't say in all instances, I don't know. But in many instances that the officer has been found wanting. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I had only those two questions. Other questions have been covered by my colleagues. Thanks, Mr. Ewing.
Thank you. Before I go to the next speaker, I see your hand, Honorable Maute.
Yeah, no, Chair, you can take me after the last speaker, it's fine.
No,
you're taking me now. No problem.
Is it a point of order? I want to raise both. You have spoken.
I have spoken here, but I want to say something for the record, Chair.
Honorable Gondwe.
Chair, are you going to come back to me? I'm asking.
I'm giving you an opportunity to raise your point of order.
Oh, okay. No, Chair, I was saying that since you're aware that Advocate Dalunkofu did not finish his cross-examination, I'm sure arrangements will be made for Mr. Pile to come back so that Advocate Dalunkofu can finish.
No, that's not even a point of order. Thank you, Honorable Maute. I'm not going to entertain that. Honorable Gondwe.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good evening, Mr. Pile. Mr. Pile, you stated in the course of your evidence in chief that Mr. Gordon was not per se the primary target in the PP's investigation into the unit, but rather the capture of SARS was the primary target. Please expand on what you mean by this, and please take us into your confidence on who and why SARS was captured.
It's a long answer to this, Honorable Member, but I'll give you the short one. And in some instances, I'll be repeating myself, but I think we accumulated a large number of enemies over time in SARS. And they stretch on a continuum from disgruntled employees to taxpayers who were not who were serious evaders. It also stretches to political fixers and politicians, and it stretched to crime syndicates. And a big part of playing a big part in this is the tobacco syndicates. I think that around that time, 2014, came the perfect storm. About 2013, we had some political cover. And it's important, we had a situation where Mr. Manuel had been a minister for 10 years. And in SARS, we had Commissioner Godan for about that period. For institutions to grow and become effective, you need that amount of stability. But I think by 2013-2014, we were about one of the last remaining institutions, together with Treasury and so on. Most of other institutions, in my view, were already taken over and they were dysfunctional, becoming dysfunctional. Just it was SARS and Treasury and some other institutions under Treasury that stood outside, in my view, outside the hands of the capturers. And it finally came to SARS, and then it finally did come to Treasury. And then what happened is that you had a big exodus from SARS, and you had quite a big exodus from the Treasury also. Thank you, Honourable Member.
Thank you, Mr. Pillay. Mr. Pillay, in the course of Mr. Van Logenberg's cross-examination by Advocate Mpofu, this committee was shown a letter dated 18 February 2021, written to Advocate Mkhwebane by the current SARS Commissioner, Mr. Keith Vitter, when he informed her that SARS would be relocating with equipment forming part of her investigation into the alleged rogue unit. Which equipment had been securely stored in the basement under the supervision of DPCI, the SSA, and SARS. What do you know about this equipment? What sort of equipment was Mr. Keith Vetter's letter referring to that was stored in the basement under the supervision of DPCI, SSA, and SARS?
Okay, so Honourable Member, the first thing to say is that equipment is not equipment that can be said to have belonged to the investigation unit in question. It's not true. I would say it's a lie. So that's the first thing. The issue of the equipment is dealt with in some length in the judgment of the second investigation. They really go into it in quite some length. And it says that allegations about the equipment, no evidence has been presented by anybody and by the public protector to say what is this equipment and where it is. In fact, the judgment is very critical. Was the public protector is saying, because you are a unit doing unlawful things, you must have equipment. Therefore, if we can't find the equipment, you're hiding it. So there is equipment of some sort which was bought by the Security and Anti-Corruption Unit for SARS. They used that. It was not used by UNIT, and it was used for security purposes in SARS. There's other equipment that is talked about, like night visions and so on. This is equipment delivered to SARS after 2014. And this equipment comes from the United States Customs, who provided this equipment to SARS Customs. There is no equipment that this unit has bought, and I provided to the Skakani panel, the report of the CFO, who said there is no such procurement. And in fact, the Skakani report says, by the way, this is early now. So this is in 2014, end of 2014. Skakani report says, we found no equipment. He actually said, it must be said, we found no equipment. So this equipment is one of these things that is bandied around. But there is no such equipment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pillay. Mr. Pillay, we heard from one of the witnesses, Mr. Ibrahim, that the office that Advocate Mkhwebane occupies requires and demands a high level of responsibility, professionalism, ethics, and impartiality and independence. So my question to you then becomes, in your view, and in light of what has transpired between her and yourself. Do you think that Advocate Mokoani has lived up to this responsibility that her office requires and demands?
Through you, Chair, Honourable Member, it's difficult for me to make a general position on these things, because really then one has to look at all of the activities and all of the cases, and one would have to, on balance, take a view. But equally as important is to say, what are the policies and procedures, what are the investigation manuals, what's the manual about complaints? These will show what is the way in which these things are handled in that institution. So one is really what's the practice and what's the performance like, and look at it in the balance. But the other is are there very clear policies and procedures about how complaints are handled, what complaints are really investigated? When investigations start, and this is how it is done. How do we ensure that the investigation is done properly? We don't have findings that are always overturned. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pillay. Mr. Pillay, I'm asking the next question on the back of the third report. Does it appear to you that despite being admonished by the courts in the review applications, Advocate Mokoani is determined at all costs to prove that the unit was rogue and was established and operated under your guidance and management in a manner that contravened our country's intelligence laws? If your response to this question is in the affirmative, please confirm why you think she's determined at all costs to prove that the unit was rogue. Why? What does she stand to gain from coming to such a determination and implicating you and others in relation to the function and the workings of the unit? In simple and blunt terms, does she have some sort of a grudge against you or vendetta against you? What exactly is going on here?
Honourable Member, look, so let me get clarity. So the third investigation is actually about procurement IT, which investigation was begun in SARS by Tom Moyan. He had started a project called Project Line and focused on the IT part. So that was obviously, in my view, was a way to take control of the IT capability in SARS and to get rid of the then head of IT, Mr. Barry Hall. We had one of the best IT shops, IT capability in the whole of South Africa. So that is the third one. It puzzles me. I don't know the answer, because no notice, no single engagement. She went through the whole process and there's a finding at the end of the day, which I read about in a newspaper. I then get hold of the legal team that has worked with me to say, guys, can you find out for me? Can we get a copy of this? I believe that there's a finding here. So for me, it's very puzzling when in two judgment, one gets seriously criticized. And then in the third investigation, one doesn't do the most basic thing, which is inform the other party of the allegations. It is really, really puzzling. I just can't fathom why it is so. I can fathom why there was an attempt to breach the walls in SARS and take control of SARS, and why there was an attempt to take control of the treasury. But why in 2019, 2020, 2021 to continue with this? Beats me. It really beats me. I would really love to. I know with all this talking about bugging, I should be very careful, but I'd love to be a fly in the walls when these things are discussed to really understand why this was done. It's the most basic thing that one should afford one's, if you want to call it one's adversary. Oh.
Yeah, I think that you have answered, Honorable Gonda, your last point.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. In paragraph 10 of your affidavit, Mr. Pillay, you state that you've been embroiled in endless litigation with the PP for a number of years at a great cost to you. Please take the committee into your confidence regarding you know, this cost on a financial and a personal level.
Chairperson, sorry. We've already had the evidence that it's 4 million rand. I mean, we're having questions being asked that have already been answered.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Aaron, for raising that. Yeah, let's complete it. We're at the end.
Okay, I think Honorable Aaron should just allow me to ask my questions. You know,
sorry, the directors are very clear.
Please don't interrupt.
Asking questions that have been asked already.
Thank you, Honorable Aaron. Let's complete it. I take your point, Honorable Aaron.
So, should I answer, Chair?
Yes.
Yeah. The number that I was given was approximately 4 million. That's the approximate number, which is the costs. That's not the whole costs for us that we have experienced since 2014. That's another matter. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Pillay. I just have three quick clarity questions, and I'm going to guide you so that we don't go too long. Sorry, before I come, Honorable Laguda, you're correct. Come. I almost forgot you with this load shedding, you're in and out.
Okay, thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Good evening to you, my colleagues, the public protector and her team, our evidence leaders. Good evening, Mr. Pillay.
Good evening.
We really appreciate you availing yourself for this process. Mr. Pillay, when you were being cross-examined, you made mention that the high-risk unit, which is called the rogue unit, was not spying on anyone. So I want to know, how did the formation of this unit assist the state in dealing with criminal elements?
Yes, thank you, Honorable Member. As I said, this unit in its lifetime has worked on 81 projects. After the first year or two, it was reduced to 7 people. So it's a small number of projects, but it did invaluable work. It did that work which a normal member of SARS wouldn't want to do. Because remember, SARS is essentially a civilian organization, and quite a bit of transgressions, especially on the customs side, is done by organized crime. And many normal SARS, ordinary SARS members wouldn't want to operate in that space. So they were prepared to work in that space. And prepared to take a little bit of risk. And these were people who could take care of themselves and not expose themselves needlessly to risk. A lot of the work they worked on was on drugs, cigarette smuggling, making and manufacturing of counterfeit cigarettes, abalone. I can't remember all of them now, but when we started with a focus on five parts of the illicit economy. And I should say that it was very important in these five parts to understand it as the whole value chain in that business, like abalone, and then try to intervene in a way in which puts pressure on the value chain. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pillay, for that response. In your tenure at SARS as the Deputy Commissioner, were you in any way pressurized by politicians to do your work in a manner that will compromise your principles?
It happened on two or three occasions. It didn't happen on more occasions because we made an early decision to live our lives in such a way that we would not, in the ordinary course of socializing, be in situations where we would be put under pressure. So there were instances. One very, very early on. And I said to this very senior person, we are prepared to help, but we can only help according to law permits us to do. There was an attempt to say, let's target so-and-so. What can you do as SARS? On two occasions was raised with me, and we said, no, we do not do that. We act according to the law, and if you want information from us, you should request it in the normal way in which the law allows. So there were, I should say, not many instances. There were a few instances. Maybe for me, in my own understanding, there were about a handful. There were a few others with others. But generally, we worked in such a way, our policies and procedures were good, our processes were good, our checks and balances were good. Of course, people would have broken through, but they would have been the exceptions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pillay, for that response. After that interaction with the senior person, as you were saying, what was your relationship with that particular person after you refused to accede to the request?
So, honorable member, let me tell you what I did. I didn't refuse outright. I said, we are prepared to help, but we can only do it according to the law. And then a week later, he sent me an emissary. By the way, he happened to come from the intelligence agency. And he said, look, so-and-so sent me, there's things that you can help. And I said to him the same thing. I'm prepared to help you. You've got to do these things according to the law, and I can really help if your person will come clean and disclose everything, because the law allows us and our policies and procedures allow us to be more lenient with somebody when they are cooperating with us. That was the last that I saw of that emissary. Never came back.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pillay. Then you also made mention just that because of the so-called rogue unit, you made many enemies. Were there lives that were lost because of this? Or maybe I can say, were people's lives in danger because of the so-called rogue unit's work?
Yes, there was some danger, and I think Johan van Lochrenberg spoke about that. A few people were killed. I wouldn't say that linked to any sort of necessary political inspired incident. But there were attempts which I believed to be more criminal than politically inspired. But there have been other incidents of housebreaking, breaking into cars, stealing computers. That has happened to a fair number of people. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Pillay, how did you become aware of the third report, since the public protector didn't give you any notice or subpoena?
I saw a report, honorable member, in the newspaper saying that the public protector has completed the third investigation and she's released her findings and she's found findings against, I think it's about five of us. And I saw my name there. But what I did is I contacted my lawyers to say, can you have a look at this? Now, I was aware that there was an investigation. I was aware because Barry Hall, Oprah Mabashula, I didn't know from Mr. Praveen Gordhan, because I hadn't seen him in some time, that all of them had been contacted by the public protector on this matter of the IT procurement. I had expected her to contact me at some stage, because I was also at SARS, but she didn't. So I saw it in the newspaper, and then it was confirmed by my lawyers. Thank you.
Why do you think, if I may ask, the reasons for her not notifying you about this investigation?
Yeah, I said, it's a question one of your colleagues asked. It baffles the mind. I really, because it's the most fundamental mistake to make.
Okay. My last question, Honorable Chair, to Mr. Pillay. When you responded about the people who were working in the so-called rogue unit, you said they were people who were capable of taking care of themselves. So, from the security point of view, I would think by that response of yours, these people were highly trained and they were highly trained to take care of themselves, and they work undercover like spies. Is this true? My assumption.
The people in that unit, many of them came from the Defense Force and from national intelligence, from foreign intelligence, from some of them from police intelligence. So they had a background in intelligence. There would be no point in creating a unit to work on the illicit economy that didn't have an intelligence background and that they didn't have the capability to avoid risks. So for me, it floats. They had the capability. And what is true, and I want to be very precise about this, they were shielded in the sense that they didn't operate openly in SARS. Not everybody knew them operating there, but they were registered SARS employees. So if people went into the SARS files, they would see their names. But these were not people seen every day in SARS offices.
Okay, thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Thanks, Mr. Pillay, for your responses.
Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Lagode. And thank you to you, Mr. Pillay. Perhaps just the last few clarity questions. And I said just three. I might make them two. The first one, Mr. Pillay, is in respect of the 81 projects. What was the benefit to the Republic of the 81 projects?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I could even make a request later that I could we can send you reports about the 81 projects. But the benefits were that we confiscated tons of tobacco.
Tons of what?
Tobacco.
Okay.
Smuggled tobacco. Tons of counterfeit cigarettes. We really hit them hard. There are reports, and I'm sure Mr. Van Lochlenburg can provide them, some old reports, but I'm sure a request to SARS can show that. Very, very early on, there was a big drug bust in the Natal area that this group was involved in. We did a lot of work on abalone. But the key thing about it, as I was saying, is that we tried to understand the business. What's the business and how to choke the business? And in the results, we disrupted the business. Where it was possible to get people arrested, we did, and we confiscated products. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you. My next point will go, and I'll want to flight bundle F, number 70, which will be a letter from SARS. I want you to take you to the last paragraph of that letter. Mr. Pillay, you might not have it, but we'll quickly assist you. Are you winning, Tsepo? Let's just start from the top and show it and then go to the bottom.
Oh, well, then yes,
So this was would have been the letter. You see what was sent to and copied. Go to the last paragraph. So last paragraph. So perhaps let's go to point C. Point C says the equipment in question was not procured nor used by the high-risk investigation unit. Is that your understanding?
Indeed, it is.
It was procured in line with last procurement policy and used by a unit as well called the Anti-Corruption Safety Unit, currently known as the Anti-Corruption Unit. Is that your understanding?
Indeed, it is so. It was so, and it is.
It was so, and it is so.
Yes.
So you agree with that assertion?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Can remove
that.
My last point.
Chair?
Advocate Mbofu. Yes, Advocate Mbofu.
Okay. No, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to know what's happening now. Are you leading evidence?
No.
What is this? And now, which rule evidence. Are you allowed to bring new evidence now? Are you an evidence leader, Chair?
Thank you, Honorable Advocate Mbofu. You know that I'm not an evidence leader and there's no new evidence. This is all in the bundle F which you have.
I've not seen it and I don't know. I haven't, seriously.
All of us have.
I accept that it's in the bundle, but I have not seen it.
Thank you. It's accessible in
Parliament. Can it be led through the chair? Now, I just want to know, I'm being serious, Chair. Can it be led through the chair? Is this the kind of document? Because I don't know what it says here.
Okay. Thank you, Honorable Mbofu. We'll attend to you on that. I'm going to my last point.
All right.
My last point, Mr. Pillay. Colleagues would have touched this. I just want to deal with 2 points on this. And briefly, were all these positions where people were rehired, advertised per the policy?
It's a good question.
Yeah, I know.
I wouldn't know. I think we should ask it of SARS HR to give us clarity on that. But I cannot point you to anything to say, here's a policy, etc.
The question is in two parts. So the first part says, where these positions where people were rehired advertised as per the policy. So you wouldn't know if it was advertised. So does it mean that you did not apply?
Well, normally, like, for example, say Mr. Kosi Low or the first commissioner of SARS who was rehired on contract, they're normally appointed as specialists. Normally, that's how it's done.
Okay.
I don't think it is advertised because there is an allowance in SARS policy for the commissioner to appoint people or, and by the way, any other senior manager, they apply for an exemption to HR, and then from HR to the commissioner, they apply for an exemption to say, this is a person who's here, this is what he's done, and we want him, and then it's done in according to an exemption. So in other words, I must correct myself, there is a system, it's an exemption system, and it's usually recorded as an exemption rather than pretending to go through an advertising process.
And in your knowledge, did they compete with other applicants and got these positions on merit?
Chair, they would not be competing because the positions would not be advertised. The appointment is on an exception basis.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your responses there, Mr. Pillay. I just wanted to place those issues for my own clarity on record. And at this point, I'm going to invite Evidence Leader Advocate Bauer. If you have any questions to the witness.
We have no further questions. We know the arrangement was that Mr. Pillay would avail himself for today, and we can't weigh over time, and we indebted for his time. Thank you.
No further questions. Thank you. Thank you, Advocate Bauer. With that, colleagues, we have reached the end of our interactions with you. Do you have anything to say, Mr. Pillay?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Thank you for inviting me here. And I appreciate the questions and the attention from the members and the evidence leaders.
Thank you. You are now excused.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pillay. Thank you, honorable members and colleagues. We adjourn our meeting.
Yo, thank you, Chairperson.
till one, Chair.
Recording stopped.
Thank you. Till Wednesday. Okay, then, Chair.